Welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm your host, Howie Jacobson. Excited to let you know that you can now pre-order my new book, You Can Change Other People, The 4 Steps to Help Employees, Colleagues, Even Family Up Their Game. I wrote it with Peter Bregman, who is my coach teacher, my coaching mentor, and it's now available for pre-order. And when you pre-order, you get a whole bunch of fun, valuable bonuses, including 3 recorded demo conversations where we show you exactly how to go through the 4 steps with real people, and a 1-page cheat sheet so you can follow along. The book itself, when you pre-order, will arrive in your mailbox or inbox on September 22nd, 2021. Here's how to do it. Go to plantyourself.com/pre. That's just P-R-E, all lowercase. That will forward you to the page on the Bregman Partners website that has all the information about how to pre-order. Basically, you just order somewhere, either online or at your local independent bookshop, and you send us the receipt via email, and then you get your bonuses. So I'm really hoping that you will help me make this book a big success. I hope it will. You will find it very valuable, and that once you get it and read it, you'll use it and recommend it to others. And so if you've been listening to this podcast for a while and you have gotten value, this is a really easy way for you to give back. It would be a huge help. So again, that's plantyourself.com/pre, P-R-E, all lowercase. All right, let's get to today's show. So today we're going to talk about a very hot topic in health and medicine and wellness, which is psychedelics. And today's guest is Lynn Marie Morsky, who is one of the people doing the most work to bring psychedelics safely and responsibly and respectfully and equitably into the medical mainstream. So it's a long conversation. We get into a lot. She's an amazing person with a lot of energy, brilliant, committed, incredible track record of what she's done already in her career. And I think you're going to really enjoy meeting her and finding out about some of these plant substances and some synthetic substances that have huge potential for healing on all sorts of levels. So without further ado, Lynn Marie Morsky, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited for this chat.
I am too. I've been waiting for this for actually several months since I discovered your podcast, which is all about a kind of medicine that is becoming more and more popular, that is, the stigmas are falling away, and we're starting to learn more about it, which is, I guess you'd say, psychedelic medicine.
Yes, absolutely. I'm glad everybody's starting to learn more about it. That is something that we need on a very global scale to overcome the stigma of years of prohibition so that we can get these medicines to people who need them.
Right. So before we get into that, I'd love to learn a little bit about you. And, you know, I've been following your podcast. I've probably listened to 40 episodes, which is kind of a record for me.
Wow. But I'm honored.
I've actually, this is no lie, I've listened to more of yours than mine.
Very, very flattered. Thank you.
And you have kind of this sort of very impressive backstory that made me think that maybe you were in your 80s or 90s to have done all those things. So.
That's funny. So my very basic backstory is I was born in the Midwest from a very conservative family, did not do any alcohol, drugs, psychedelics, nothing like that growing up, super conservative. My undergrad was in video, my grad school was in like multimedia, then I went to medical school, then I did residency and fellowship. Both of those were in like primary care. I was still not in like psychiatry.
Wait, then you went from video to medical school.
Yes.
I feel like there's a story in there somewhere.
There are many. Yeah. No, I was a video major, and then in grad school I did half of a master's in interactive multimedia because I was a multimedia designer. I was like working during the day as a multimedia designer, figured I'd get a degree, kind of addicted to school. Halfway through, realized I was tired of staring at a screen. I thought maybe talking to people would be more interesting. And so I went to medical school. Well, actually, I went back because I didn't have any like undergraduate credits that were medical related. So I went back, did pre-med, then got into medical school, then did residency in family medicine, fellowship in sports medicine, decided medicine was not for me, but I was still working at the Veterans Administration, but in not like the traditional medical role where you see somebody every 15 minutes and it's just kind of like a mill of patients based on, you know, the American way that the system is set up. I was at the VA doing compensation and pension, which is veterans would come at the end of their service. They would get an exam by me. I would report all the things that they'd gotten, you know, injuries or whatever from the service, and then they would get their benefits. And I did that for 9 years. But during that period of time, I mean, still, that wasn't my calling. That was clearly not my calling. I mean, maybe that's somebody's calling, but it was not mine. And so then I went to law school because law is always fascinating. And loved law school. Law school was awesome. But I knew I didn't want to practice law. I just wanted to do something that combined the two degrees. And then afterward, I worked in politics for a little bit. I taught law for a while. I wrote a book on quitting things that weren't working for you, which is my whole life, which just, as you can see, just, oh, this wasn't working. Let's try this. But this whole time, you know, when I was working for the VA, I was a Department of Defense employee. And so we had, you know, we lived under the threat of being drug tested at any time, you know, just like anybody else in the military. And I'm still at this point, you know, I'm 35. I'd never even tried cannabis. And so somebody moved in next to me and said, oh, do you want to have some, I don't know, he's vaping something or whatever. And I was like, oh, I can't, I could get drug tested. And he's like, how long have you worked for the VA? And I was like, oh, like 4 years. And he's like, how many times have they drug tested you? And I said, zero. And they said, you're going to, you know, maybe they're not going to. And I was like, all right, you know, like, and you know, cannabis wasn't necessarily my jam at the time, but it did open me up to like being slightly less afraid of trying things.
Was that experience kind of getting over some of the conditioning of your childhood? Was it like, this is like a moment?
You'd think, but no, because it was literally just like, I was only afraid of drug testing, really. You know, it wasn't like I was conditioned. Oh, well, my dad was very much a don't do drugs person, but I mean, it didn't have any big significance because nothing happened. Like I tried the cannabis and nothing, like it didn't really do anything. So it wasn't like, oh, I got high and it was amazing. It just, that wasn't it. But then I went to Burning Man the next month and somebody gave me LSD and that was significantly more impactful. But in there I had like a therapeutic realization that night. And I did not know that psychedelic science was a thing. This is 2013. And I was like, wow, like that was a really useful realization I had during this night on LSD. Didn't share it with anybody. Didn't think this was a thing. And then I, you know, from there I opened up a little bit and I would do psilocybin every once in a while or LSD every once in a while. Same thing, always have some realization. I was like, wow, these very useful insights I get. And then it wasn't until 2017 when Tim Ferriss had somebody, I think from MAPS on one of his podcasts. And I was like, oh, this is a whole field of study. Like this is not isolated incidents to me. And that's essentially what changed my entire course of things. I did ayahuasca in 2018. And at that point, I'm still at the VA. And I'm going into work every day, seeing patients that have PTSD, post-traumatic stress, TBI, depression, anxiety, trauma out the wazoo. You know, they've been in war. And I can't tell them about ayahuasca. Right? I can't tell them about any psychedelic. I can't tell them I've done it. I can't recommend it to them. And, you know, as physicians, our oath is first do no harm. And at some point I felt I was doing a lot of harm by omission when you know something could help people and you're not telling them. So in 2019, I up and quit. I had no backup job whatsoever, but I was like, this is out of alignment. I need to quit and I need to make it like my life's mission to spread this word to other clinicians. I mean, I didn't spread it to patients. But clinicians tend to listen to other clinicians, right? Doctors will listen to other doctors. And if you educate one doctor, that person might see 100 patients a week. And instead of giving antidepressants to all of them, they could maybe recommend, hey, ketamine might work. You know, ketamine's available right now. And so I was like, I see that these medicines are going to become FDA approved. What if no doctors know about them? They're still not going to prescribe them. And patients are still going to get the same ineffective therapy.
You're not going to get, cheerleaders coming with lunches and
you mean drug reps?
Yes. I meant drug reps.
Yes. 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 And I will not disparage drug reps. They are, you know, they serve a very important purpose because after medical school, we don't have a formalized way of learning about new things that come out on the market. You know, like that's just not like, unless somebody shows up to your office and tells you about them, we might not know. And that's the issue with psychedelics because right now ketamine is generic. Nobody is paying outside of Johnson & Johnson, who now has esketamine, Spravato, but nobody is paying somebody to go office to office to tell primary care doctors, hey, generic ketamine that is, you know, $1 a bottle could do much better for your patients. And that's what I formed the Psychedelic Medicine Association to do. So to back one step up, when I first left the VA, I started the Plant Medicine Podcast, which is what you were referring to as a way. I wanted it to educate clinicians, but then I realized that's not how doctors or therapists learn necessarily about things. They don't have 45 minutes to sit down and listen to a podcast. They want to get snippets in their email that they can easily digest. So I keep doing the podcast, but then I founded the Psychedelic Medicine Association to formally educate clinicians so that they had the full range of options and they would start having these conversations and feel comfortable having these conversations so that when more of these medicines become available, they're ready and feel good, like they're educated enough to discuss them with their patients.
Mm. So there's so many little moments there that I wanted to kind of like dive into, but specifically, I'm going to stay on topic. Like you said, you felt like you were doing harm by omission. So you'd mentioned Burning Man, you'd mentioned doing a few things. Like where did it flip over for you from anecdotal to there's overwhelming evidence that this is something that an evidence-based physician should be sharing with their patients?
When Tim Ferriss's podcast came out, that's when I knew, oh, this is a, like, you don't, I keep telling people, they, you know, people often disparage doctors. Oh, they're keeping their head in the sand. I was like, guys, doctors cannot go home and Google something they've never heard of. Like, if you've never heard of psychedelic medicine, you can't go home and Google psychedelics for depression. That's not like, you can't, you know, like, so I was at that place. I wasn't sitting there Googling psychedelics helping anxiety. I wasn't on PubMed, which is where you look for, you know, evidence. I wasn't Googling psychedelics and PubMed because I didn't know that was a field that existed. It wasn't until that episode came out that I was like, oh, let me follow maps. Let me open, you know, like, start listening to the research, following these people. So, you know, that's when everything changed.
Gotcha. So one of the things that I really appreciate about your work is that you insist on context, that there are plenty of people in this neck of the woods who are evangelists, who are extremely convinced that their perspective is completely right. And I see you as just like always increasing the context, always increasing the balance so that you're giving people the best information we have. Could you talk a little bit about sort of like first there's like, okay, I did ayahuasca, or I did LSD at Burning Man. There's not necessarily any political, social, racial, economic concerns that go along with that experience. And yet you are continually putting plant medicine into all sorts of other contexts of justice, of fairness, of equity, of healing. Can you kind of talk about your evolution?
Yes. And I appreciate you for saying that. I don't necessarily think about our work in that way, but I'm glad that you have appreciated that we have really tried to bring up, you know, we've done episodes, psychedelics and the LGBTQIA2 spirit community, psychedelics and communities of color. Because I, luckily, you know, there are a lot of kind of, you know, mostly good intentioned watchdogs in the psychedelic field, and they will call out when things are being overlooked. And so I distinctly remember I had put up a post on Instagram saying, you know, from my very privileged existence, you know, middle class, white female, I said, go to your doctor, tell them everything you're doing. They should know every substance you're on, right? And what I'm thinking of is just preventing, you know, interactions with antidepressants, that kind of thing, you know? And somebody commented, yeah, that's fine for you, but there are people who, if they admitted to using an illegal substance, they could lose their benefit. Hmm. You know, they might get turned in by their doctor and lose their children, you know? And I was like, wow, thank you for bringing that to my attention. Like, that totally kind of smacked me in the face. And also the work by Dr. Carl Hart, you know, the first time I heard him talk about psychedelic exceptionalism at Horizons in 2019, I was like, wow, this is information. Again, you know, it wasn't even in my sphere of knowledge. It's once you hear it, you can't unhear those things. Mm.
Can you briefly describe what that is? Cause I'm not sure that many of my listeners will be familiar with his work.
Absolutely. So, and I'm paraphrasing Dr. Hart's work. Please check out his books, many books. I think his most recent one is called Drug Use for Grownups. But he talks about psychedelic exceptionalism, which is essentially, you know, we have the drug war, which was not ever a war on drugs. It was a war on communities of color. And, you know, he very succinctly points that out when you like look at the difference between the penalties for cocaine, which, you know, the upper class white people are doing versus crack, you know, like it was like five times the sentence for crack, which was in the lower socioeconomic status communities. And he points out that, you know, when we keep talking about psychedelics, like they're not drugs, like they're better than heroin, they're better than crack, or they're better than meth, you know, like here's this, you know, they're all drugs. I mean, caffeine is a drug, alcohol is a drug, right? But we like specifically put psychedelics in this one area and kind of lift them up. And if we do that and continue to demonize the others, that's essentially psychedelic exceptionalism. It's like the drugs that people can, you know, generally white people with means can afford, you know, psychedelic therapy at this point is not cheap, right? So those of us who can go and spend all this money to go to an ayahuasca retreat and do quote unquote plant medicine, you know, that's okay. But the person who is still struggling, they may like struggling mentally or with whatever else, and they're turning to something that they have available to them, which might be, you know, heroin or crack or meth or one of these other things, then like that's still continuing a divide. That's still continuing that war on communities of color. That's putting our, you know, our in the psychedelic community, our means of healing ourselves above other people's means of finding some peace in their life, you know? And, you know, Dr. Hart will say, oh, I, you know, I'll do heroin, this and that, or, you know, I mean, whatever his, I think it was heroin that he mentioned, you know, and it's about using it in a certain way and not abusing it or taking it with context, set and setting, all the things, you know, but essentially, you know, as I ramble on, but the point is we have to take care to not continue to stratify things in those with means versus those without means. And the psychedelics that those with means can access are plant medicine are better than others. And there are still other bad drugs. Like, that's what I want to, you know, I was mentioning to you before we started, I'm changing the name of the Plant Medicine Podcast to the Psychedelic Medicine Podcast, because I don't want to at all be part of that exceptionalism. Like, the name was essentially Plant Medicine Podcast because I wanted to include cannabis. And, you know, to call it a psychedelic medicine podcast, initially that wouldn't have made as much sense. But now I definitely focus on psychedelics, and I don't want to be part of, you know, I just saw Jada Pinkett Smith, and they did this awesome thing, but they continue like on psychedelics, and they had these experts on, and it was great, but they continue to call it plant medicine the whole time. And that, I think, continues to put it in this like woo-woo place. You know, they're all Schedule I drugs. I think actually heroin might be a Schedule II drug. You know, like these are even scheduled higher in the DEA's which are dangerous drugs classification, which we all know is bogus. But like, it's not, we want to make sure that we're not stratifying things any further and continuing this war on communities of color.
Right. Okay. But then that's interesting. And I definitely, you know, for the listeners, we're going to get into like the facts on the ground about psychedelics and how they can be part of a healing process. Like, so I kind of explore this a little bit more, because I've like a lot of the interviews I listened to kind of smacked me on your podcast, kind of smacked me upside the face. So I have participated in, you know, certain of these events where, you know, from my perspective, I was like honoring the indigenous people whose culture I was appropriating. Right. Like, you know, this is plant medicine because it's ancient and the plants spoke to these people. And yet, I'm doing it in the comfort of my home, thousands of miles away from where the plant grew. And yet at the same time, like, you know, sound like you at LSD at Burning Man, I had some very profound healing experiences. And I found myself afterwards trying to, you know, like, am I a good person? Am I a bad person? You know, how can, you know, there was a way in which the story of the plant and its relationship to these indigenous people that I see myself as an advocate for was actually playing into a very egotistical narrative that I wasn't aware of.
I am confused by the question.
I know. Yeah, I don't think there was one.
Okay. You paused. I'm like, I don't know what to say.
I was hoping you were going to help me. you've had guests on who have focused on how we can advocate for the people, for the indigenous cultures and people, without just expropriate. Like, I kind of felt like I was expropriating the same way I'd go to Mexico and come back with beads or a hat or something that I was, you know. While this stuff was incredibly helpful for me, it was also a form of appropriation without recompense. And I wonder if you could help me think about that.
Sure. I am by no means the authority on that. I do know who is. I would say chacruna.net. They really specialize in that. And they have this big Indigenous Reciprocity Initiative, I believe it is called, the IRI. And, you know, I'd head on over there. They, you know, sign up for their newsletters. They're the ones who are, you know... and I see a lot of companies that are even in the space. Luckily, they are they've got some byline in their, you know, finance sheet where 10%, you know, social responsibility is a big thing these days. And in the psychedelic world, I see a lot of the companies taking their social responsibility funds and sending them towards indigenous. Whoever has set up funds for indigenous healers, somehow for these to go back, you know? So if you're an individual person, maybe check out the Chacruna series on indigenous reciprocity. I would say, you know, first, very basic, you acknowledged it. And you acknowledge that this has a lineage and tradition, and that you showed gratitude for the people who came before you. And I think, you know, at a very basic level, continuing to respect it. You know, like, I mean, these, again, I don't want to say recreational versus non-recreational. I don't want stratification, but I still see a lot of people, you know, I hear about, oh, I ordered ayahuasca in the mail and I'm going to do it home by myself. Like that, anything that leads to a bad event is both hurting our industry, preventing other people from possibly healing in the future, and I would say not necessarily honoring the ancestors and the way they would want these things to be done. Like, they set up traditions because that's the way they were safest. And, you know, granted, like, we on in Western, we can throw more safety on top of it, trauma-informed healing and consent and all these things that may not have been specifically outlined in their trainings. But they're the ones who know how to work with this medicine. And so for us to take it way out of context, like, if you're going to do it in your home, whatever, I mean, I've done ayahuasca outside of, let's say, super, you know, I've done it in the jungles of Colombia and I've done it outside of the jungles of Colombia. But still, when I do it outside of the jungles of Colombia, I'm doing it with somebody trained in the Shipibo tradition, you know, so that lineage still comes through and I still get to respect and do the medicine in the way that I believe the original finders and harbingers of these medicines would want it done. But, you know, past that kind of respect, I would say, you know, if you're looking to donate every year, look at an indigenous reciprocity, some kind of fund. You know, I'd say like chacruna.net is a great resource for that. And there are a number of other kind of adjacent type things that you can donate to continue to honor those people.
Mm. So you talked about honoring the ancestors. And what suddenly came up for me is, how do you talk to MDs about a drug regimen that honors the ancestors? You know, when it's so different from the way we think about, you know, pharmaceutical quality and protocol.
Yeah, there are like many million-dollar questions in getting this into our Western medical society. And that is one of them. So we just ran the Sana Symposium, first ever psychedelic specific conference that psych conference was putting on for clinicians. So there's 1,000 clinicians on these calls. And I was on the steering committee and we're like, you know, how do we bring in the indigenous? And, you know, you just mention it. But here's the thing. There are indigenous traditions for ayahuasca, ibogaine, psilocybin, and from the psychedelics, I think that's about it. Peyote, mescaline. But look at the medicines that we're using now. Ketamine does not have an indigenous tradition. So I don't have to sell them, you know, to tell them ketamine is a thing. I don't have to explain that. MDMA does not have an indigenous tradition. LSD does not. 5-MeO-DMT. A lot of people think it has an indigenous tradition. It does not. About half have a tradition. So it's kind of like a combo conversation, because we're telling them on one side, here's something completely synthetic created in the lab, MDMA, for example. You just do really good therapy and we'll tell you how to do the therapy. And that therapy may borrow from some indigenous practices of sitting with people. But there's no MDMA tradition. And then on the other hand, we have these other medicines, and the medicines that have the indigenous traditions outside of psilocybin are really, we're going to have to do some work. Like when ayahuasca or ibogaine becomes closer to FDA approved, I mean, that they're significantly further away, not impossible. Luckily, people are working on it. But you're right, that's going to be a whole different conversation. So I think, you know, now that we've got psilocybin approaching phase 3 trials, and that does have a tradition, but it's not necessarily a tradition that's being carried out in these trials. It's a conversation to start having, but you're right. It's with clinicians. I don't want to overwhelm them with background of the medicines that are coming. I think if we inform them little by little, A little buy-in here, a little buy-in here. It's kind of like with cannabis, right? If we could get somebody turned on to CBD, oh, they're okay with CBD. That is a form of cannabis. Maybe I can get them turned them on to THC, right? And then little by little, I don't insist that, you know, they get flooded with this information. Just we kind of keep it in the background as mentions here and there so that they're familiar with the terminology. And then when ayahuasca and ibogaine, for example, become, you know, closer to FDA approved, hopefully this will not be such a kind of a shocking conversation to have.
I mean, the other difference that I can see is that, you know, clinical medicine is always focused on the individual, right? How that's the locus of what I'm trying to fix. As I come from a public health background, which is looking more broadly, and I would argue that the indigenous traditions of psychedelics are looking at a communal level or a planetary level. How do you talk to physicians? Like, there's ways in which we can just sort of steal all this stuff and use it for shits and giggles, right? And there's ways in which it hopefully it could transform and elevate our society to become more ecocentric and less egocentric. How do you think about the, you know, that merger so it doesn't become, you know, us just instrumentalizing these gifts?
I think we started, like, you know, within the Psychedelic Medicine Association, our very first monthly webinar, we talked about increasing access to ketamine therapy, which, again, ketamine is not something that has an indigenous tradition with it. However, one of the people who was discussing, and by increasing access, we were talking about how ketamine is way too expensive right now. How can we get this available to more people before it gets covered by insurance? Because outside of the Johnson & Johnson project, it is not generally covered by insurance. And one of our panelists, she hosts group ceremonies. And so I think that is a good way, you know, talking about accessibility to get buy-in from clinicians as to, you know, we've heard of group therapy. We know that's a thing that exists, right? And it may be a thing that exists, one, because of cost, because it's more cost-effective to group therapy for many. But also, you know, things like AA and all these other recovery groups, they have a group component, a community component. There's a reason these aren't done one-on-one. And so it's not that the concept is completely unfamiliar to clinicians. I think it's just going to be have to be another part of the education, which is, you know, with a lot of the psilocybin work that Imperial has done and Dr. Roz Watts, with how important that the community aspect was for integration. I think it's just part of, you know, if we continue to talk about integration, you know, that's a whole new conversation for physicians to have. If we mention community is important for this, and then we mention, hey, group settings are cost effective and sometimes they have added benefits. I just think, like with everything else, it's trickling in, taking the avenues where we're already familiar. We already know what group therapy is. Okay, well, group, now we are doing group therapy, but we've added ketamine, right? Like, it's not like we're totally blasting the mold of what they know is possible in the medical world. Like, there are little inroads. And so just taking those inroads and working with what people are already familiar with and just showing them there's a little additions here that we can make in the psychedelic realm and get some big benefits.
Mm-hmm. Great. Gotcha. So let's dive into some of those benefits. Cause I know, you know, when I first started hearing about it, like LSD was what bad people did to have trips and they're still messed up and, you know, you could go crazy in the jungle. And it took, you know, it took a lot of tenderizing to get me to open my mind and heart. And frankly, it was not from spiritual people that it got through to me. It was from, you know, doctors, from people in MAPS, a multidisciplinary association for psychedelic studies. Is that right?
Well done.
Yeah. The silent P gets me every time.
Silent P. Yes. And I think a lot of people are like you, like they are more on the conservative side. And so until they hear that there's science behind it, then it's a harder sell. So I don't think you're alone.
Right. So what would you see, you know, so just, For the uninitiated, let's pick a substance, pick a psychedelic medicine. What do you think is particularly interesting right now in terms of clinical uses and evidence for it?
We'll pick psilocybin because then nobody can say I didn't pick a classical psychedelic because ketamine and MDMA are not classical psychedelics, right? So
okay, so what is psilocybin? Where does it come from?
That is for the super nerds out there. Psilocybin is psilocybin mushrooms. So we're talking about the ingredient from magic mushroom. It has been shown, it is heading into phase three trials for depression. It has been shown to help with end-of-life anxiety. One of my favorite studies, maybe my favorite study, is the psilocybin for tobacco cessation by Dr. Matthew Johnson at Johns Hopkins. It showed something like 60%, I believe it was 60% at 1 year were abstinent from smoking after two sessions of psilocybin and cognitive behavioral therapy. Like no patch, no Wellbutrin or whatever other things do, no vaping. Like this was, they did psilocybin twice and did some cognitive behavioral therapy, and at 60% at a year. Those are not numbers I've ever seen in smoking. And now psilocybin is being investigated for headaches, chronic pain. Psilocybin has DMT in it, just like ayahuasca does, and they are finding that DMT has like neurogenesis properties, which is like regrowing or growing new neural cells. So, somebody's investigating DMT for stroke patients. So, psilocybin has DMT in it. So I think psilocybin will also have some interesting effects in that realm. So it's currently my favorite because it's just this wide range they're investigating for it for eating disorders. Like there's a wide range of things that come up both when you're doing it with therapy, but also just on a physiologic level, it appears to have these interesting effects. So hopefully that's a good example of the benefits.
Great. I remember listening to Michael Pollan talking about that the smoking cessation study, where since they were interviewing the people about like why'd you stop smoking, and they would say like things like I think he called them like duh moments, like oh I realized it wasn't good, it was like messing up my lungs. It's like and you didn't know that before, like that was news to you, but somehow the truth was able to penetrate the veil some more. What do you
Yeah,
think? What do you think is about psilocybin? Like, what's your sense?
I don't know. I've never had a cigarette in my life. It's really hard for me to determine that one. But what I do know from other journeys I've done is that suddenly, like, I have a greater respect for nature and kind of the interconnectedness of things and respect for things. And so maybe if you weren't respecting your own physiology and your own lungs, or your health, or say you're part of a family and you're smoking and you've got kids and you think like, oh, well, my lungs go out, and then my kids don't have a parent. Like maybe just it's that, sense of connection. A lot of times they say that the mystical experience leads to the most change, but I cannot tell you which part of the mystical experience it is that necessarily leads to it. But I do know that a lot of people I know who do psychedelics, for example, they drink a lot less. It's interesting. I think it just brings things to your consciousness and to your awareness that make you want to take better care of yourself in many different ways. And I can't pinpoint what it is, but those are, kind of my guesses, is that like it makes me want, I'll do a journey and then I'll be like, I just want to eat fruit for a week. I'm not a big fruit eater regularly, but it's like I want to be full of nature, and I don't know if maybe they're thinking like, wow, why have I been poisoning myself this whole time? I should breathe, Mother Nature's air and be healthy. I don't That's my guess. Not a great fortune teller with that, but perhaps.
Yeah, my reading about it is around sort of really dampening down default mode network and parts of the brain that are constantly telling the story of ourselves. And I don't know if it's legal for me to have done psilocybin. So, but I will say that if I had done it, the experience I would have had would have been one in which like nothing was more important than anything else. Like
We'll say you
really.
did psilocybin in Amsterdam, where truffles are legal.
Okay, sure.
I saw you there. That's
Yep.
where
And
that's definitely where it happened. Okay, continue.
then I imagined I was in my backyard thinking I was going to walk around and appreciate the beautiful zinnias in bloom, and finding myself drawn to the mottled speckled leaves and the dirt, and realizing like sensing that there's this brain now, this is hard. There's a program that's constantly running in my brain that's saying, what's in it for me? Is that good? Is that bad? And it's probably, it seems like a very useful survival thing most of the time. And it was turned so far down that nothing was privileged over anything else. the grass and the trees and me. It was all on equal footing. And it felt, you know, and to this day, like I can't get there, like in my sort of normal consciousness, but knowing that there's a there makes a difference.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I like how well you put how that would have gone had you done it.
That's my guess. Yeah.
that's your guess. That was very cute. Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny that you mentioned that because I've had people, you know, one of clinicians' biggest concerns is, are these addictive? And we keep telling them they're not addictive. They're anti-addictive, right? Like they actually can help you get rid of your addictions. And then if you take too much of it, they just stop working. But literally when you tell them something like that, they're like, but wouldn't you want to be in that state every day? And like, I mean, in theory, but it would stop working. And you also need to like be productive at some point. And also, I mean, there are other ways you can get there. But yes, like in that state, it is glorious, right? Like, especially the like for, had I done it, I think the thing I would have gotten the most out of was that, I'm just kidding. I totally have done it, but, I'm very open about that. But is that there's a connection, right? We live in the US. Everything is polarized. And when I do that, I feel like, oh man, like we're all connected. We should stop. You know, like I feel less anger toward the quote unquote other side, you know, or whatever, that kind of thing. And wouldn't I love to live in that state and not live in the state that's super polarized? That would be great. But yeah, I think that's a huge benefit of these, especially in communal healing. Like one of my favorite studies that was done, and this is just, you know, an intro study, and you know, a lot of people got kind of up in arms, like this is not going to solve the world's problems. Yes, but this is an intro study. Is the study that was done with the Israelis and Palestinians drinking ayahuasca together. Like, look up that paper or listen to that episode of my podcast. It's just incredible that, you know, that let's say from one side, you know, an Israeli soldier who never necessarily thought twice about, you know, putting himself in the shoes of the people he was going to, you know, pull out of Palestine or whatever his story was, you know, he's like banging down somebody's door. And the thought of listening to Arabic music was terrible, whatever. Then an Arabic woman is singing in Arabic during the ayahuasca circle. And he's like, this is beautiful. And then he could like put himself in their shoes. Like you know, that connection is a huge bridge to healing on a societal level. So yeah, like they're that default mode network tuning down and the connection tuning up have many benefits.
Yeah, I love that you brought that up because, you know, when I was preparing for this conversation like months ago, and there's a whole bunch of stuff I've just forgotten. And that was what got me most. First of all, these two beautiful souls that you're talking to, the Israeli and the Palestinian, who are working on this together. And then following up on the reports, I first saw it in, I think it was a MAPS Facebook post, and then seeing the vitriol on the comments was so bracing and hard to read, because having a sense of like the beauty that happened there, and then people just reacting from their worst places.
100%. That's well put. That must be actually the post that MAPS posted of mine that you saw. But I ended up running into, you know, when I interviewed them, Lior was in England and Antoine was in the West Bank, I believe. And then I ran into Lior in Berlin. And I was like, well, that was the most commented on podcast we've ever done. He's like, yeah. He said, I was getting, you know, like he was getting anti-Semitic things thrown at him, and he's Jewish. You know, he was the Jewish half of this research team, you know, like, I mean, it's just, tensions are so high in so many conflicts, and especially one that's been going as long as that. And it's like, God, what I wouldn't give for the people in that comment section to sit for an ayahuasca ceremony with the people on the other side of that comment section and then reevaluate, you know, afterward. Like, cause you're absolutely like, that's the, you know, well put. I've never put out something that was supposed to be more inspirational that caused more hate, you know, and a little saddening, but also look, you know, I'm sure that there were people who sat for ayahuasca that could have been those commenters before, you know, mm-hmm. who might have felt that strongly about either side. And then they were brought to a new understanding, you know, so it gives me hope that hopefully as the, you know, these medicines are used more intentionally in these bridge building ways, that we can reach some of those people and lessen those tensions.
Right. And at the same time, I've heard people in the psychedelic community, and I kind of felt this way or would have after my psilocybin experience, had I had one, that like what I just want to do is like put it in the water in Congress. Like there's this conceit that like it's just going to fix everybody's brains. We're going to stop being, you know, selfish assholes.
Right. That would be the goal. It's funny because I was just thinking about this today, like putting it in the water, metaphorically, sounds great. I have been in places where people are handing out microdoses and, you know, and I've sat with the consequences of that when somebody should not have been taking even a microdose. You know, they get nauseous, they, you know, it ruins their night. Like these are best done in settings that are controlled. Like if you had been in your backyard, you know, maybe even better had a sitter been with you in your hypothetical backyard. But like,
my hypothetical then 23-year-old daughter would have been.
That's beautiful. Even better. You had like a family member. That's great. But even better if she was trained. Anyway, I keep digressing. This is the lawyer in me. Like, don't ever say a thing that could actually come back to you. Don't suggest your daughter sits with you, you know? We were talking about, putting the politicians. Yes, if we could get legit ayahuasca ceremonies with both sides of the aisle sitting together, my goodness, you know, like, I mean, I was just at an event, a fundraiser where Rick Perry spoke, you know, Rick Perry, former governor of Texas, and he was ranting about the amazing benefits of psychedelic therapy, whereas I had assumed he would only rant about things that I would not believe in, you know, from his background, right? And so like, it is very possible. This is something that, thanks to veterans, is getting bipartisan support. But yes, once it gets that support, I mean, when we decriminalized DC, not we, but decriminalized DC, I was like, oh my God, please get those people in DC some of these decriminalized substances and in a proper set and setting so that we can start this healing. Because we do want to put it in the water safely. And we do want, you know, politicians to feel this sense of, I mean, especially the ones that don't seem to have a real sense of community or caring about the environment or caring about the other classes that don't maybe look like them or earn like them. I would love for them to have that. But, you know, again, that's on the level of imagining the best about psychedelics, right? That's why I continue to specify. We'd want them in a good set and setting because we don't want them to have a bad trip and then never want to give, you know, psychedelics or healing to anybody else.
Right. Great. Can we talk about cannabis?
Can. I'm not an expert on it.
Okay.
I will try my best.
Right. Well, I can find, but I mean, you know, it's the more I read about it from a evidence-based perspective, the less I'm sure, right? This is one of those substances where there's more and more research that's showing harms, at least that I'm seeing as showing benefit. And maybe I'm a dupe of whatever media filter I'm getting. But I keep seeing, psychologists and psychiatrists talking about, like, maybe it's not good for younger people, or maybe, like, yeah, maybe there'd be some medical, there's some pain relief, but there's also increased incidences of depression, anxiety, bipolar. Like, what are you seeing?
Oh, mostly, I mean, again, caveat, lawyer disclaimers all over the place. This is not my specialty. But I actually am the medical director for a cannabis and psychedelics website. So I do have some knowledge, and most of the negatives that I see, like, I'm surprised to hear you say that mostly you see negatives, because I generally see all the negatives coming in the same vein, which is overuse by young people is problematic. Like, that actually has studies that show that there can be consequences. And perhaps just like with other things, if you had a predisposition to schizophrenia, bipolar, psychosis, one of the things, I mean, like, those populations are being currently mostly kept out of psychedelic study, because whenever you start messing with the psyche and there was already a fragile, you know, maybe genetic predisposition for something, then we may be in more of a danger zone. So if you're seeing those kinds of things that are spurred on by cannabis use, it's probably cannabis overuse and in a fragile population. Like, did somebody smoke, you know, a joint one time that was of moderate strength and they suddenly had psychosis? That's not a story I ever see, right? It's generally really continued heavy use, or maybe they took way too many edibles and then they, you know, because especially edibles at some point can become psychedelic, right? Like, you can lose all, you can have all the same kind of, most of the same kind of delusions that you would have with a psychedelic.
Yeah, if I'd had two brownies that one time, just because they were tasty. That would have messed me up good for several hours.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, those are really uncomfortable, anxiety producing. You know, we know that cannabis can cause paranoia. That's well known, right? So if you've got a super high dose, it's getting psychedelic, you get paranoid. And sorry, I'm going to cough. And outside of that, you might have already had a genetic predisposition toward one of these conditions. Yeah, that seems to be a concern. But I'm, you know, looking at how many things CBD has been shown to be beneficial for on the medical side. I mean, there's like Epidiolex, which is, you know, now a FDA approved medicine for seizures in certain types of pediatric seizures disorders. We have Sativex. I mean, I'm thinking, and you know, I see that it's helpful for MS, spasticity, lots of areas, sleep, you know, there's, depending on what, you know, CBD, especially good for sleep, you know, so I think it's the same cautions that apply to psychedelics. And then also maybe this additional caution with use in youth, under age 15, they say those are the big ones I see. Again, like that's not something that I'm mired in quite as much as psychedelics, but most of the harms. And then there's cannabis use disorder, which is again, like a use disorder when they, you know, because they say cannabis itself is not addictive, but you can definitely develop a use disorder with it. And there are withdrawal symptoms and all that kind of thing. So, you know, that's still in the more, again, a lot of these fall into, are you using them intentionally or not? I don't want to say recreationally versus medicinally, but intentionally versus not. I know good friends that said, man, I noticed I was smoking a lot more cannabis and it was just like out of habit. And then I was like, why am I doing this? I'm not doing this intentionally. And then they just stopped. Like, and then from then on, if they're going to smoke cannabis, they're going to say, what is my intention with this right now? You know, cannabis is a plant, just like these psychedelics are some, you know, plants. They're substances that are psychoactive, plant or otherwise. And with psychedelics, we ask people to have an intention and a set and setting and to take it intentionally and not just ignore the dose and woof some down and go party and not pay attention to your safety. Like, well, the same thing should apply to cannabis. We're not telling you to, or nobody's suggesting that it's healthy to do it all day, every day, willy-nilly, not paying attention to the dose, not doing it for a specific reason, you know, perhaps then disorders, you know, or problems are going to be more likely.
It seems like my guess is that what I've been reading, sort of coming from mainstream sources, is still very heavily tinged with morality.
Right.
There's a lot of pearl clutching, right, and a desire to find the negative and to highlight it and blow it out of proportion.
Yeah, and I like, you know, if you were to, off record, you know, like they send me, here's everything I've seen, like I would be interested to go through it and you know, as anybody else diligent would, to look at who's sponsoring this study. Is it pharma, who currently a pharmaceutical company that doesn't have a cannabis product? Sure, they have every reason in the world, if they especially are making like SSRIs or something, you know, like who is sponsoring this? Is it, like, as you said, is it from a more conservative institute, that kind of thing? Or you're right. They're, you know, a lot of these could be tinted with morality. That's why I'm pretty proud of the psychedelic science world, because it is, you know, it's seemingly not at this point, you know, if it's tinged with anything, it's tinged with caution, but not with morality. And so that's my hope, that the cannabis space gets to that same place too.
So if someone's listening to this and, you know, what sort of medical conditions might somebody think, hey, cannabis is something that I might try if I haven't tried it and other things aren't really working?
I can't say that. That's less like medical advice. So I would advise you to listen to some of the episodes of the Plant Medicine Podcast, because because me telling somebody personally that to use something when they've tried everything, that I'm a doctor, can't do that. Lawyer, remember. But check out the Plant Medicine Podcast episodes on cannabis for PTSD. I don't think there's episodes necessarily about this, but you know, Google cannabis and pain, cannabis and muscular sclerosis, cannabis and chemotherapy. That's a big one. Cannabis for nausea, cannabis for chemotherapy, CBD for sleep, CBD for, I mean, if you listen to the episodes, the very first episode of the podcast is somebody who did CBD for back pain and he avoided back surgery. So lots of conditions, generally, you know, if taken, and again, if you're going to take one of these and you're already on any medicines, because, you know, in your scenario, they tried everything, they're probably on some medicines, right? Go to a cannabis consultant. There are plenty of, you know, doctors out there, MDs, DOs, that do cannabis consulting. So they can look at the medicines you're on and say whether or not there will be a interaction, because these medicines, some of like CBD oil, for example, is metabolized by the liver. Well, so are the drugs that you take orally, and there can be some interaction. So just make sure you check with a medical professional. If you go to your own medical professional and they say, I don't know anything about this, then please go seek out a cannabis consultant. And if you are a person who has at the end of your rope with any of these things, then please see a cannabis consultant regardless, because maybe they will have some thoughts on how you may safely use a cannabis-based product for your condition.
Okay. So now I think I know how to ask you questions. So what should somebody Google?
There we go. I can educate, not prescribe. There
we go. if they are concerned about, they might want to try one of these substances and they're not sure if it's legal where they live, or like, do they have to travel? Are there dispensations?
Oh, you're talking about psychedelics now.
Let's say cannabis.
Oh, okay.
Like I'm in one of the holdout states in North Carolina. My kids both are in Portland, Oregon. So, very different scene there.
Very. I'm in California. Very Portland-esque scene here, I believe.
Right. I mean, so are there still legal issues? Let's say we're a podcast host to actually admit that he used rather than, you know, telling hypothetical, like what's the legal landscape? And I know you had a wonderful conversation with someone, say a couple months ago about, all the legal concerns.
Oh, I'm blanking our Delta 8 name. Conversation. Oh, we haven't had a conversation with a man about cannabis legality in 2 years, but we did have somebody on talking about Delta 8 and some of the legal issues there. Her name was Dr. Carrie Clark. But right now it changes by the day. Like suddenly a legislature will be like, nope, cannabis is legal. Like, or they've changed it from totally illegal to medicinally legal. Or they change it from medicinally legal to recreationally legal. Like my parents' state just changed like out of nowhere. I think maybe the last election. It's really hard to keep up. So I do not have a great resource because again, it's so fast. It doesn't even have to be at an election. Like after an election, you can generally tell like, okay, they'll broadcast these kind of things, but it may just be that your city council, you might be in a completely criminalized state and your city council may have voted to decriminalize all entheogens, plant-based entheogens, which will include cannabis. So like District of Columbia, they decriminalize all entheogens are the word for it. It's another term for psychedelics, basically. It's kind of like plant-based things that help you know God or things that help you know God, kind of some, I'm botching the terminology here, but so a lot of places have decriminalized natural entheogens. Like Detroit just decriminalized, Seattle just decriminalized. So it's even city by city. So even just looking state by state is hard to tell. So I unfortunately do not know. I'm sure somebody online, maybe Drug Policy Alliance, maybe that's a place to look. DPA, not 100% sure. It sounds like they would be something against drugs, but they're actually very much against the drug war and very into good education about drugs. So they may have a resource, but somebody would have to be literally on that with the, daily. I hope that somewhere on the internet exists a, let me put in your city and currently are things, what is legal and illegal in that city, but that, there's 380 right. million people in a jillion municipalities. So I don't know that that's possible.
We need a map.
We do for cannabis, for sure.
So I want to talk a little bit about your podcast.
Okay.
So the first thing is that the way it's organized is you have like four different conversations initially about each substance. And so it's a very much a choose your own adventure. Right. How did you, when you first said, hey, I'm going to do a podcast, how did you first come up with that?
Well, I love that you used the exact phrase that I think I used in the pilot episode, because it is totally choose your own adventure. I'm looking at other podcasts in the space. And if I were, I wanted this to be for clinicians at first. And I was thinking of what holes could a skeptical clinician try to poke in psychedelics, right? If a patient comes to them and says, I was thinking of using ketamine for depression. What do you think? The first hole I could think is they would poke in and be like, that's going to be scary for you. And the second hole could be like, there's no research behind that. And the third hole could be like, I don't know if the person's going to do it safely. And the fourth hole could be, that's probably illegal, right? Those were kind of like the four things that I thought would be their doubts, right? And so then I thought, I'm just going to create an episode for each one of those. And that will help patients, because patients can go straight to the patient experience episode and listen to what it might be like to try ketamine. And then, you know, the patient or the clinician could go to the scientific research episode and find out exactly what research has been done to kind of quell that doubt. And then if they wonder, gosh, what is it going to be like? What are the people who administer this? What's their training like? What are they going to do in this ceremony? That's helpful for the patient who might want to know. And their physician may also want to know that. And then they both probably want to know, is this legal? And like, what's the history of the legality? And so that's how I set it up, because I love many of the other psychedelic podcasts out there, but they'll like have a big name person on and they'll discuss like 70 different topics. And I might just want to know, how did the ayahuasca help their depression, right? Like, where in this 2-hour long episode do I find that information? So that's why our episodes are, you know, generally like 40 to 60 minutes, and they focus just on one aspect of one medicine, basically. And hopefully that will help users navigate, because say you have depression, you might just look for all the episodes that are focused on depression, because we have like ketamine for depression, psilocybin for depression. And if you instead have really been curious about psilocybin, then you can just go to all the psilocybin ones, the psilocybin patient experience, scientific research, blah, blah, blah. And then you can also go to the psilocybin for depression or psilocybin for eating disorders or whatever. That's not one that exists, but there's psychedelics for eating disorders. But I just want there to be lots of easy ways for you to dial in just the information you were looking
for. Beautiful. Yeah. The other thing I wanted to say is that I love how you podcast, like the way you introduce topics and the way you talk to your guests. Like I was listening thinking, I got to up my game a little bit. Lynn Marie's really, really present, really good at this. And I'm wondering, like, how do you prepare for conversations and how do you think about drawing out your guests? Because you have a wide variety. Some of them, many of them, English isn't their first language. They're, you know, either very medically bent, like they're not natural communicators, and you get them to communicate beautifully. I'd love to know your secrets.
Wow. That is a huge compliment. And by the way, I'm being hosted by you right now on this podcast, and I find it very enjoyable, and I think you're very good at it. So I think you're not giving yourself enough credit, but I will take the very nice compliment. I think I always have, I think many of us have this, anybody who's listening can identify with me. I am overly sensitive to what other people are feeling. And so as I'm podcasting, I am 100% in the listener position, which actually kind of makes it hard because I have to like separate two parts of my mind. The one is like still trying to pay attention like for the content. And the other is like, am I bored or am I confused by what this person is saying? And so if either of those things are true, I just try very hard, especially if like, you know, they're getting way into the weeds on something or they're using a lot of, you know, medical terminology, I will ask them to backtrack. Like, okay, say we don't know what the CYP450 enzyme does. Can you explain to the listener, you know, because I want it to be super accessible and I don't really know. I mean, I don't know that I have any other tricks depending on the episodes you've listened to. Like if I have these big name researchers on, it is my, you know, it's the bare minimum if you're going to research these, let's call them geniuses, you know, but they've dedicated so much work to this. I need to know their work. So I'm going to have looked up their research projects. I'm going to have taken thorough notes and I'm going to take notes on the things that I think the listener is going to care about the most. You know, I never want this to be like what Lynn Marie cares about the most. Every once in a while, you'll hear me say, for selfish reasons, I'm asking this question. For the most part, it's like, what is I just want it to be useful. And I know that even like if I'm listening to a podcast because I want some information and I'm way too bored by the time they get to it, I've tuned out and I didn't get the info, you know? So I just want it to be digestible and to get right to the point. And it's so funny because as you call these, I'm like trying to think back to who you're referring to in these, but I don't know aside from that I just put myself in the listener's position and try my very darndest to get them the information in a succinct, understandable format.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing I noticed is that, you know, in your introductions and outros, when you talk directly to the audience, like I really felt like we were buddies. You had no idea who I was, but I'm like, you're my friend. I'm your friend. You know, we should hang out. And I'm wondering what kind of feedback you've gotten, like what you hear. Because podcasting can be a very lonely thing, right? Like after the conversation, you're like, it's you and the editor and the audio and the website and all that stuff. And like, what kind of community has coalesced around the podcast? And, you know, how does it feed you?
That's really sweet. And we are going to be friends. I love that the thought that anybody listens to it and just thinks they're my friend. Though I will tell you, I was in Berlin and I'm at a psychedelic conference. We have all of our masks on, right? And this woman, she, you know, we have name tags and like, you know, we were talking in the bathroom line and I said, what's your name? And she holds it up and then her name tag. And then I hold up mine and I said, I'm Lynn Marie. And she goes, oh, Morsky? And she's like, can I hug you? And it was so cute because like same thing. She just thought like we were besties because she listened to the podcast for so long, you know, and it was like absolutely made my day. I think it's funny because like at the beginning, I used to edit out any time that I would like make a mistake. And I'm hoping that by now I've put out 98 episodes that like we're friends. You guys know I'm going to make a mistake every once in a while. But like even, you know, you and I on this podcast, right? Like there are probably things I have said to you that other people would have not said. I'm just kind of filterless. And I think that's how you can get me like, get to know me very quickly without really having to know me very well. Is like there's clearly, you know, I'm just like you kind of get the full Lynn Marie at every time. So
right, minus med school and law school, of course.
Well, what do you mean? What do you mean?
I mean, you have these very clear like I'm not allowed to say this. I can't go there.
Right, but like the full Lynn Marie tells you without being very like. Well, let me phrase this gently. I'm like, nope, not answering that. Like I just just kind of unfiltered. But yeah, like it's really sweet how many people, like when I go into psychedelic conferences, like I had somebody just at the last conference in Miami say, I was going to do ketamine and I listened to all your ketamine episodes in exactly like the format that you had it laid out. And I got to hear the research and I got, to, and it was as if I'd like somebody had paid her to tell me your plan worked. And I did it as, you know, and so you're right. There is like a little community. I have not nearly fostered it maybe as much as I could have because I've been busy doing the association kind of thing. But it's funny, every time I want to kind of put the podcast on the back shelf, like somebody else will come out of the woodwork and be like, your podcast has helped me so much learn about these things. And then, you know, like I realize that there is like with your podcast, there's a community out there, whether or not you know they exist. When they pop their heads up and like weigh in with feedback, it reminds you that like, yeah, we actually are a community. And it would be pretty rad someday to like somehow have a in-person gathering where we all hang out together.
Yeah. Yeah. But your podcast is also, you know, an enduring body of work. Like it's like thinking about like writing a book instead of a blog post. Like this is something that people are going to be going back to for years as a resource. It's not just, hey, what a fun conversation.
Yeah. And it's my second podcast. My first podcast is on the thing I wrote a book on, which I said was like strategic quitting. And it's funny because that podcast is consistently ranked like number two career podcast in Morocco. And I'm like, oh, I'm glad somebody's getting use out of this. They just send me the stats all the time. Uzbekistan's really using that podcast. But still, I will get people that still email me, you know, like, wow, your podcast helped me quit my job that wasn't working. I'm like, okay, cool. So yeah, like I am super stoked that it's going to live in perpetuity. I mean, it's not going to be ending anytime soon. It's just going to be morphing to a new name. But yeah, like anybody who is interested in getting just the facts from this girl, and not from me personally, but like me having these fantastic other lovely people on, because I continue to say I am not the expert. I just have experts on and bring them to you. My only expertise is in knowing what doctors do and do not know about psychedelics. But yeah, thanks for the kind words about it. And yes, it will continue to live on.
Excellent. Let's close out by talking about what seems to be the project closest to your heart right now, the Psychedelic Medicine Association. So what's that work? Because I have a lot of listeners who are plant-based doctors in that they tell people to eat plants for their health. Okay. So this is a way maybe they can expand their plant affiliation.
Right. Well, dear doctors and therapists and nurses and Reiki practitioners and acupuncture people and medical students and everybody out there who a patient may go to, this is for you all. We started the Psychedelic Medicine Association to educate clinicians of all varieties on these medicines. Because if a patient comes to you and says, I'm sad, I'm anxious, I have these post-traumatic stress syndrome symptoms, I'm having difficulty sleeping, I'm having pain, Like, we know the things that we're currently giving them for most of those things are not that effective, and that psychedelics are showing to be very effective. But they've been criminalized or stigmatized for so long that we're not taught about them. So even when they are available, like ketamine, your average doctor is not prescribing them because, one, they may not know about it, and two, they may not feel comfortable. So that's the gap we're trying to bridge. We want the people in the middle of nowhere, North Dakota, to be able to go to their family medicine doctor, and their family medicine doctor knows that ketamine is an option right now, or that in a few years, MDMA is an option. Because doctors, you know, we have a, we're not necessarily that we're so conservative, is that we're in a litigious society, especially here in the US. And if we do something wrong, we're going to be sued. And that always weighs on us. It's always like hanging over us. And so we have to act more conservatively than we would if that weren't the case. So doctors, even if they hear about this, maybe in the media or whatever, they may still not feel comfortable having that conversation unless they've got a lot more education. And it's going to be a while before these are educated or taught in medical schools or residencies or fellowships, or before that drug rep shows up and says, how about MDMA? You know, so we're trying to bridge that gap and educate doctors on that before, I mean, ketamine, like I said, is already there, but before we've got these other drugs that become available, we want clinicians to start getting familiar with so many of the aspects you talked about. Like super kudos. You asked some amazing questions about talking to clinicians that nobody's asked me before. So give yourself more credit. You're a fantastic podcaster.
I didn't say I wasn't. I just said I wanted to up my game.
Oh, well, I think your game is very high. My humble opinion. Because you're right, like clinicians, we've got a lot to go through. Like, okay, we're going to have to totally change what you think about therapy. It might take 8 hours, and you don't take two of these, call me in the morning, you take two of these ever, and then you may be cured. Let's hope. These have traditions, these have different interactions, and all those things we have to talk about with doctors. So if you are a clinician and you would like to learn more about psychedelics, or you would like your clinician to learn more about psychedelics, head that person over, or you head over to psychedelicmedicineassociation.org and join. And we send, every month, we send like 5 or 6 of the latest articles in psychedelic science. And then we have a webinar with members only every month, which is the most fun because we get experts from the industry that come on and give in, like you can interact with like experts that are very hard to get to otherwise. Like a lot of people I've had on the podcast are that, you know, they come and they sit on these and they will, you know, you can interact with the people who run MAPS, like the MAPS did an all MAPS panel, and people could ask them one-on-one, how is this rollout going to look? And then MAPS was asking the doctors for feedback on things like, okay, do you know anybody in your state who could help us with this type of legislation? Like it's the sandbox that we want to create where everybody's helping each other move these forward. It's, you know, we've created it, but we've invited everybody in who's not only just, you know, we educate the clinicians on what we can, but all these other experts come. And then, and education is just one part. You know, there are other people in there that are helping move forward research or move forward legislation or move forward accessibility, but everybody can come together there in the association and try to get this whole movement forward more quickly.
That sounds great. Cause I have to say that my 21-year-old son, 22 now, he will consider me a successful podcaster if I get Rick Doblin on.
Oh, let me tell you, that is my next interview.
Oh, well, 2 degrees of separation. I'm going to let him know.
Yes, it took a while. I wanted him to be my 100th episode. And luckily, down to the wire, he is going to be my 100th episode.
Oh, nice.
I think about 2 weeks ago, spoke with him and he accepted. And so I am extremely excited for that. Yes, absolutely.
Nice.
It's a big honor. He's obviously like a giant in the industry. He's the reason most of us are able to do what we do today. And so I'm very much looking forward to that.
Right. And just a quick brag on my son. He was 2 or 3 years ago was traveling back to the States from Colombia, and he recognized Alex Gray in the airport.
That's very cool. I like every part of that story. My favorite Alex Gray story is that at Burning Man in 2009, I was having just a very rough week. I had volunteered for Zendo and some overnight shifts had really like taken my energy, just, you know, being like off, you know, having to be up all night, not doing the Burning Man thing and sleeping all day. So I was a little off and I was like, I really need something to kind of cheer me up. And I see that they're going to have like a Tool album release party for the band Tool. And I go out to it and it's on this giant art car is Alex Gray bringing his seemingly his own copy because, you know, he's done art for Tool. He brings with this copy of their brand new, never heard before, Fear Inoculum, it was. And He is rocking out. It is, I have a video of it that I will never ever delete. It is maybe my favorite video, watching Alex Gray rock out to Tool at Burning Man. So tell your son high five.
All right.
big Alex Gray fan as well.
I'll put links to both Alex and Tool in the show notes.
Awesome.
I want to let you go, but I just want to say I don't think we'll have time to talk about it, but the episode that made me cry was Heroic Hearts.
Oh, Jesse.
And just maybe just say a sentence or two about that.
It's funny that it's that one. Generally, Mikey's episode makes people cry, and that was the 5-MeO-DMT one. But listen to Heroic Hearts as well. Jesse Gould is a former Army Ranger, and he started Heroic Hearts Project after experiencing his own healing through ayahuasca. And now he brings veterans down to different ayahuasca facilities to help them get that same healing. But you know, Jesse and Heroic Hearts, as well as Marcus and Amber with Vets, are two veterans organizations that when you hear their story and you hear the stories of how many people they've helped, it will really touch you. And, you know, especially with, you know, they're working with populations that are, it's hard for them to admit they even have a mental health concern. And they're not used to, you know, giving up complete control to a substance maybe, and letting over the reins and having some shaman do their thing. You know, this is a lot of out of, you know, the realm of their norm, and they're being vulnerable and they're experiencing incredible healing. And so many of them feel really compelled to go on and share it with others. So yeah, listen to the Heroic Hearts episode. That's the ayahuasca patient episode. And again, another a Navy SEAL who did 5-MeO-DMT. That's the MEO 5-MeO-DMT patient episode. And then Marcus and Amber with Vets, that episode too. All of those, which will be pretty touching.
Right. And I remember, you know, like sometimes Leah listened to a podcast and then you can remember like what you were doing, where you were in space when you heard a bit. Like when he was, I remember I was like doing yard work and I remember where I was walking when he said, and they were asking me to surrender. And as a, like, I never surrender. And like the courage that came in that statement, which was sort of the, he had been trained to think of the opposite of courage. Surrender is the opposite of courage. Like that just destroyed me. It was so beautiful.
Yeah, I will pass that along to Jesse. That will mean, I'm sure, a lot to him that really got to you. Yeah, that's exactly what I was saying with, like, this is not what they're used to, and it is taking a lot of, you know, for them to put their mental and physical health in somebody else's hands. But when they come out of it, so many of them are like, you know, you've saved my life. And that's what these organizations are trying to, you know, make a dent in this unfortunate veteran suicide epidemic. And so yeah, it's really an honor to everybody else that they're so open and vulnerable with their stories, because it's helping a lot of people get healed.
Absolutely leaders in a much bigger field than they ever thought they would be.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's end with, where can people find you? I know you're changing the name of the podcast, or is
It's yeah, it should be in the same location. I mean, right, you know, by the time you hear this, I don't know when this goes out, but it probably will be called the Psychedelic Medicine Podcast, and that's on Spotify or Apple Podcast, Stitcher, any of those places. Currently it lives at plantmedicine.org. And then if you are interested in finding the Psychedelic Medicine Association, that is psychedelicmedicineassociation.org. And like I said, clinicians, we would love to have you join us.
Okay, I will put all that in the show notes. And thank you so much. This is such a, like, when I look at like everything we know about medicine and healing, and there's so much with promise that is so far out, that's so untested, that's so, like, you know, and yet we have this huge body that's ready for us. And all, like, what we just have to do is change some hearts and minds and create new availabilities. And you are, you know, a leader in that movement. And I just, you know, I'm so honored to have spent this hour with you and so grateful for the work you do.
Well, very kind, and I really appreciate that acknowledgement. I'm happy to have been healed, you know, by these substances, and so it's just my honor to have any role in passing them on to others.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, and hope we'll stay in touch, and one day we'll meet at a conference.
Sounds fantastic. Thanks again for having me on.
A pleasure.
All right. Hope you liked that one. If you want to find out more, follow the links to the Psychedelic Medicine Podcast or the Psychedelic Medicine Association. You can do so over at the show notes for today's episode, which is plantyourself.com/499. So Garden did a new bed. I was out dumpster diving for cardboard. One thing I've learned in years of dumpster diving cardboard and putting it in the garden is remove all the plastic tape first. Otherwise, you're going to find plastic tape coming out after the rain. It's like the hand, you know, in the cemetery in the horror movie, just seeing this plastic bubbling up, and we don't want that. So I remove it all first in the driveway, then put the cardboard down, and then I put some loads of compost and mulch on top of that. And so hopefully by next fall, we will have another bed ready to go. So a lot of my movement news this week has been gardening, schlepping compost, mulch, wood chips. Went for a little bit of a run the other day and played hard ultimate on Saturday. It was cold. Not that many people showed up. So we were playing what's called Savage 6-on-6. Savage in the ultimate world means no subs. So still recovering from that a little bit. Yesterday, I managed to get a decent kettlebell workout. One of the things I like doing is short kettlebell workouts, more intense. Like if it's just 10 minutes, I'm like, all right, I'm going to go do it. But if it seems like 30 to 40 minutes, I can easily talk myself out of that. So the exercise was 15 seconds of work, 15 seconds of rest, alternating between squats and swings. And it sure wore me out. All right, time for thanks. Thanks to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use his beautiful song, Sabali Dawn, The Dance of Peace. You can find more of Will's music at his website, willridenour.com. And of course, thanks to all of you Plant Yourself Podcast patrons. Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Brittany Porter, Dominic Maurer, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatherley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Ellen Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Tina Scharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Filkinofsky, David Bizek, The Mysterious Michelle X, Elsbeth Feldman, Leia Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Landry, Josina, Sarah Durkis, Kelly Cameron, Janet Selby, Claire Adams, Tom Franza, Jeanette Benham, Gila Sert, David Donahue, Blair Cyborg, Dorona Vizov, Gio and Carolyn Argentati, Jody Friesner, Misha Rosen, Michael Warbeck, Aviva Lael, Alicia Lemus, Val Linneman, Nick Harper, Bandana Chali, Molly Levine, The Inscrutable Harry R., Susan Laverty, The Panda Vegan, Craig Kovic, Adam Scharf, Karen Burry, Heather Morgan, Nigel Davies, Marion Blum, Teresa Koppel, Julian Watkins, Breed O'Connell, Sharon Hirschman, Linda Ayad, Holm Hedegaard, Iza Tuzinwa, Connie Hainline, Aaron Greer, Alicia Davis, Heather O'Connor, Carolyn Jensen, Sherry Olakoski of Plant Power for Health, Karen Smith, Scott Marani, Karen and Joe Crabtree, Kirby Burton, Teresa Carell, Kevin McCauley, Elizabeth Rothschild, Ann Jesse, Cheryl Dwyer, Jenny Hazelton, Peter W. Evans, Dennis Bird, Darby Kelly, Lori Fanny, Linnea Lundquist, Emily Iconelli, Levy Wallach, Rosamund McAtee, Dan Picorni, Stephen Leenan, Patty V. Martino, Mike and Donna Kartz, Deanne Bishop, Bilberry Elf, Marjorie Lewis, Trisha Adams, Nancy Sheldon, Lindsay Bayshore, Gunmarit Hagen, Tracy Gullidge, Laura Heaton, Meg from Mama Says, Stacey Stokes, Ben Savage, Michael Kay, David Hughes, Connie Rogers, Claire England, Sally Robertson, Paranganchi, Amy Daly, Brian Tourville, Mark Jeffrey Johnson, Josie Dempsey, Karen Schmidt, Pamela Hayden, Emily Perryman, Allison Corbett, Richard Stone, Lauren Vaught of Edible Musings, Aaron Hasty, Sean Owen, Sagar Nayak, Erica Piedra, Danielle Roberts, Michael Lushton, Sarah Johnson, Catherine Floyd, for your generous support of the podcast. That's it for now. As always, be well, my friends.